Well, good evening to everybody. We are in our sixth week of our course entitled, Are You a Renaissance Christian? And of course, we have been talking a lot about Christianity and the life of the mind, that believers should value, cultivate, and pursue the life of the mind to the glory of God. And really, we are focusing on three areas in this class together. We have looked a lot at the question of reading and relying upon the Adler Van Doren book, How to Read a Book. We're now in the second part of the course where we're looking at logical issues, reasoning, and rationality. And the next 2 weeks, we'll look at the last section of the course where we'll address the question of worldview reflection. So, our approach here is that a Renaissance Christian is a Christian who pursues knowledge as a daily priority in life. The Renaissance was a movement in about the 14th century that influenced Western Europe. And this, of course, is Raphael's painting, The School of Athens, where he depicts Aristotle and Plato. And so we've been talking a lot about the question of using our mind to the glory of God. So as we think a little bit about logic and reasoning tonight, again, I'd like to remind you that our abilities, our intellectual facilities that we possess, come because we're made in the image of God. Animals, as special and as unique as they are, as wonderful as they are, animals differ from human beings not just in degree, but in kind. Only human beings have the intellectual capacities, the writing ability, the spiritual abilities, and all of this comes from being made in the image of God. And so here is that passage in Genesis 1:27. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. Well, tonight we want to talk further about logic, and of course, Christians can relate to the issue of logic. In fact, in the New Testament, Jesus is called the logic of God, the logos, the rationality of God, and studying logic has many benefits. Here are two of those quotes we looked at last time, and I'd like to read them again. Ed Miller is the author of probably the best introduction to philosophy textbook I've ever seen. It's called Questions That Matter. Ed Miller is himself a Christian, PhD in philosophy. He says, quote, "The philosopher and others who reason critically can no more do without logic than the physicist can do without mathematics." That's a powerful statement because physicists look at the world through the prism of mathematics. Philosophers and all other people who care about careful reasoning, they look at life through the prism of logic. And here is another quotation from Geisler and Brooks, both Christian apologists. Norm Geisler, one of the most well-known Christian thinkers of our time. They say, quote, "Thinking is not an option for the Christian. It is an imperative." It is an imperative. Well, let's talk a little bit about logic. Last time we were talking about some of the fundamental principles of reasoning. And I simply want to make the point here that an argument in logic is really a very simple thing. And first of all, by an argument, of course, we don't mean a verbal spat that you might have with your wife or your friend. An argument is a simple thing. You make a claim and you seek to support the claim. If all you have is a claim, then you simply have an opinion. An argument could be defined as a supported opinion. If all you have is premises or support or data, then you just have a bunch of information, and as important as that information may be or as interesting as it is, to have an argument, you have to make a claim and support the claim. The claim, of course, we call a conclusion. The support we call the premises. And good premises are constructed from facts and evidence and reason. And, of course, the better that the premises support the conclusion, then the better argument you're going to have. Well, in light of that, I want to talk a little bit about how reasoning breaks down. I want to talk about tonight how things go wrong in the reasoning process and how to correct it. So I want to talk a little bit about what we call in logic fallacies. A logical fallacy is simply a defect or an error or a mistake in the reasoning process. And it can happen in a variety of different ways. But essentially it causes a breakdown where the premises do not in fact support the conclusion. And if the premises don't support the conclusion, then you're going to have a bad argument. It's going to be invalid or unsound. It's going to be weak or uncogent, depending on whether you're arguing deductively or inductively. But one point that I want you to appreciate is that while fallacies lack logical relevance, they often contain psychological relevance, and that's really the direction that we want to begin with. And so rather than just looking at faulty reasoning, I want to present 10 principles that I think will help us to construct solid logical arguments. So a fallacy occurs when an argument contains a specific defect. This mistake in the reasoning process causes an argument to break down or fail to adequately support the conclusion. The following 10 strategies help thinkers avoid the pitfalls of fallacious reasoning. So our first principle here, and I've got 10, but since I'm not Moses, I can't make them commandments. I can simply make them principles. The first principle is, number one, focus critical attention on backing an argument with solid support. You want your premises to provide evidence. You want them to be factual. You want them to be reasonable. And you want to avoid irrelevant emotional appeals. And that's what I mean by an argument can be lacking in logical relevance, but it nevertheless has psychological relevance. And the reason that that works is because we're more than merely an intellect. We're also emotional people, and we feel the psychological appeal. Well, here's the first one I want to look at. This is called the argumentum ad baculum, which is simply Latin for an argument that appeals to force or the appeal to force. This fallacy replaces real support for a given conclusion with a threat. The constituted intimidation may either be physical or psychological, and it may be expressed explicitly or implicitly, sometimes referred to as the appeal to the stick. This approach simply conveys the point that a person must accept a particular conclusion or else. Well, look, if somebody threatens you, either physically or psychologically, implicitly or explicitly, you know when you've been threatened. And that leaves an imprint upon you. And so while it isn't logical to threaten people to get them to accept your conclusion, it nonetheless sometimes works. Here's an example of it. Bin Laden to the Saudi Arabian royal family. Quote, "You must break off all cooperation with the United States and denounce America as an imperialistic enemy of Islam. This is your moral obligation, and if you do not, Allah will surely use his agents to topple your puppet government." Well, look, all of the more moderate Muslim governments, to the degree that you accept the idea that there are moderate Muslim governments, but I do, I think there have been countries that are certainly far from radical, like bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. But you see here that this really isn't an argument. This is a threat. And he's essentially saying, yeah, you have some kind of moral obligation to oppose America, but if you don't accept bin Laden's conclusion, then he's going to use his forces to topple you. Now, there are other ways in which you can appeal to emotional appeals. One is, of course, by threatening. But the second one is the appeal to pity. This is called the argumentum ad misericordiam. Again, the Latin, the appeal to misery, if you will. While instructors tend to be good at the appeal to force, students tend to be masters of the appeal to pity. This fallacy replaces legitimate support for a conclusion with an attempt to evoke sympathy. An emotional appeal of this type, though logically irrelevant, is nonetheless often successful because it plays on another person's sense of compassion. Now look, you may decide when you are reasoning with someone to show compassion upon them. But when people try to manipulate you to accept their conclusion by pressing your emotional buttons, that's the appeal to pity. So here is a student instructor. By the way, I was the instructor who was spoken to this way. Quote, I know I failed the exam last week, but the events surrounding Hurricane Katrina have really bothered me. My family and I used to live in New Orleans, so I deserve to retake the test. Well, I might have decided to have compassion on the student, but when they told me that I deserve to take the test because of pitiful circumstances, that to me struck me as an appeal to pity. And again, appealing to pitiful circumstances can really influence people. By the way, I might say that that's especially true when it comes to Christian people who are taught that we should care about people who are made in the image of God. We should have a sense of compassion. But sometimes people can use our strengths against us by appealing to pity. Now, there's another appeal to the emotional side of life. It's called the argumentum ad populum, or the appeal to the people. And of course, human beings have certain psychological needs. I do, you do. We want to be accepted. We want to be respected and included. The appeal to the people fallacy plays on these human needs in order to get a conclusion accepted. This appeal to popular sentiment can have a powerful result, especially when exploiting the enthusiasm of a crowd. And here is, of course, a historical example, the Hitler youth leader to the student. So we place it within the context of Nazi Germany in 1938. Quote, our Führer Adolf Hitler's policies must be good for Germany. Just look at how the large crowds salute him. You too should join our victorious patriotic movement. This is exactly how Nazism became popular to many people. In fact, one of the major leaders in the Nazi movement, who was Hitler's architect and then later became a minister of armaments and munitions, a man named Albert Speer, who, by the way, Winston Churchill said was the most important Nazi, because Speer was so capable as a technician when it came to armaments and munitions, Churchill said that the war lasted 2 years longer than it should have. I read Speer's autobiography where he talked about his reasons for joining the Nazi Party. And by the way, Speer was a first-rate intellectual, an architect, a brilliant man. He said that he joined the Nazi Party without seriously thinking and reflecting about it. He was swept up into the movement. Well, I would simply say if somebody of the intellect of an Albert Speer could be swept up into a movement that led to the death of tens of millions of people, that's a message that should come very strongly to us. You don't want to be joining a ideology simply for emotional reasons. And so lots of people said that Hitler was a good leader because look at all of these people that supported him. That's the appeal to the people. These are all psychological appeals. They lack logical relevance, but they possess psychological relevance. And that's what sucks people in. Okay, our second principle, number two, openly acknowledge and seek to fairly justify any worldview presuppositions, thus avoiding inappropriate presumption. The problem with presumption is you're bringing things to the table. You haven't proven them. You haven't supported them. You're simply presuming certain things to be true. You have to be very careful about that when it comes to logic. Presumption is fatal to logical arguments because logic is about proving things or supporting things. Wishful thinking, begging the question, and the complex question are common fallacies of presumption. Instead of proving them by offering facts, evidence, and reasons, you kind of sneak them in because you presuppose them to be true. Well, let's take a look at the wishful thinking fallacy. The logical error of wishful thinking consists in assuming that because someone wants a particular thing to be true, it must be true, or assuming that because a person doesn't want something to be true, it isn't. The problem with this approach is that the wishing is treated as a premise in support of a desired conclusion, However, mere wishing doesn't make something true or false. This is called the fallacy of wishful thinking. I want it to be true, so it's true. I don't want it to be true, so it isn't true. How dangerous is wishful thinking? Well, it can be a big problem. You remember in the late 1990s, the Heaven's Gate cult down in San Diego? Quote, if we commit mass suicide together, then our souls will join the mothership that is following the Hale-Bopp comet. Don't worry that the spacecraft cannot be observed. More than 30 people died, killed themselves, believing that Marshall Applewhite was going to take them to a UFO craft. Or if you think only kooky, cultic people think that way, well, sometimes Christian people think in very cultic terms. Here's an example. I'm positively confessing that God will give me unlimited health, wealth, and prosperity. Sickness, poverty, and death cannot even touch me. Well, I got news for you. Even if you're Benny Hinn, your health is going to leave you. There's one disease, there's one illness you'll never get over, your last one. And everybody dies. But how often positive confession, wishful thinking, is certainly very fallacious. Now, another type of presumption, the Latin is petitio principii, or begging the question. This is the old-fashioned circular reasoning. The begging the question fallacy also assumes that which should be proved. The fallacy occurs when an argument either one, conceals an essential premise, or two, bases a premise on the truth of that as yet unproven conclusion, or three, it technically moves in a circle. And the problem here is you accept a conclusion that you have derived from your support or your premises. You can't reason in a circle. You can't presume the truth of your conclusion and then set up premises that artificially support it. Logic is about proving things or supporting things. Here's a couple of examples of circular reasoning, and I'll bet you've heard them. Quote, all the greatest scientists in the world believe that Darwinian evolution is a fact. If they didn't believe this, they wouldn't be great scientists. Well, that's one big circle. Or, here's another quotation. Quote, of course David Koresh was the Messiah. All of his followers at Waco believed it, and he personally taught his intimate followers about his messianic claims. David Koresh came out of a Seventh-day Adventist background, became the follower of this group in Waco, the group there, and they also committed suicide, had the standoff with the FBI. Well, these are circular claims. You got to be very careful not to presume what you want to be true. This fallacy raises questions that carry built-in unproven conclusions. And here is, of course, the complex question. The complex question is when you presume the guilt of somebody and then ask a question based upon that presumption of guilt. A fair question is simply to ask them, did you do this or not? But look at these examples. Quote, hey, Henry, have you stopped plagiarizing other people's works yet? Well, there's no way to answer that question with a yes or no. They're assuming he has and ask him, are you continuing to do so? Or, by the way, Bob, do you still use insulting racial epithets? Well, the presumption is that you do. Are you continuing to do it? These are complex questions. There is a presumption of your guilt. A straightforward question would simply be, did you plagiarize or have you used racial epithets? So these are all fallacies of presumption. You presume something to be true, and then you build upon that. Okay, our third principle, number three, exercise caution in analyzing causal relationships and conceptual comparisons. So careful thinking, when we think about cause and effect, careful thinking, and especially worldview reasoning, requires an understanding of causal relationships. However, cause and effect connections can be difficult to track, and logical mistakes can easily creep in. Here is an example of the false cause fallacy. It's one variety. The Latin is the post hoc ergo propter hoc. Literally, after this, therefore because of this. So this type of reasoning insists that because A precedes B, then A must have caused B. But temporal succession alone does not mean that A actually caused B. The connection in time may merely be coincidental. The following example illustrates. My favorite baseball player, by the way, is Ted Williams. He missed five full seasons of his career because of his commitment in World War II in Korea, and he still hit over 500 home runs. If he had played those five prime years, I think he'd have numbers like George Herman Ruth. Well, here's my example of a false cause, post hoc ergo propter hoc, after this, therefore because of this. Quote, baseball legend Ted Williams batted over 400 in the 1941 Major League Baseball season. Just a couple of months after this accomplishment, the Empire of Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. Wow, a batting slump on Williams' part might have kept America out of World War II, at least in the Pacific. Well, this is the post hoc ergo propter hoc. I'm sure that the Japanese were very impressed by Ted Williams. But by the way, I should tell you this, that when American troops wanted to insult the Japanese, they would say bad things about the emperor. When the Japanese wanted to assault the Americans, they'd say bad things about Babe Ruth. I think that tells you a little something about the different countries. This is, of course, a ridiculous after this, therefore, because of this. Simply because the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor right after Ted Williams hit 400, there's no connection here. You have to be careful about looking at causal relationships. Simply because one thing precedes another doesn't necessarily mean that it logically is connected. Okay, principle number four. Present substantive evidence in support of an argument. And this is a very important point. When you're trying to make your case, when you have an argument, you make a claim and you support the claim, have some real substance as part of your premises. Make your argument substantive by making those premises very robust. At least three distinct fallacies need to be avoided to support sound reasoning. These types of errors in thinking are especially common when it comes to promoting a particular worldview. Appeals to untrustworthy authorities, appeals to ignorance, and hasty generalizations betray a weakness when offered in support of a belief system. So let's look at these problems here. The first one is called the argumentum ad verecundiam. Notice, by the way, how much of this is Latin. Latin is a critical language, and by the way, Latin is a critical language when it comes to Christianity. For 1,000 years within church history, Latin was the fundamental language of Christian theology. This is, of course, fundamentally true of the Western church. But Latin is a language that is really a language of the intelligentsia. So argumentum ad verecundiam, this is the appeal to an untrustworthy authority. Now, there isn't anything wrong with appealing to an authority. You know, I might quote Mortimer Adler when it comes to education. I might appeal to some great philosopher or some great theologian to support an argument that I'm making. But the problem here is you've got to make sure that the person you're citing is really an authority, really is a trustworthy authority, and people can lose their authority in a variety of ways. One, they just may be unqualified, or two, they may be deeply biased, or three, they may not have the facilities in order to qualify. I mean, if you're appealing to a blind lady to support her witness of a crime, that's going to be a big problem. Just as it is very difficult when you quote somebody who is prone to bias. So that's the problem of the ad verecundiam. Be careful about appealing to authorities. Make sure they really are genuine authorities. The second one is the argumentum ad ignorantiam. The appeal to ignorance. And how that happens is nothing's proven in the premises, but you still draw a specific conclusion. For example, if I said nobody's ever disproven astrology, therefore astrology is something that should be accepted. I don't have a right to draw anything as a conclusion if it's not supported in the premises. If nobody's ever proven astrology right or wrong, then I just simply need to say nobody's ever proven it right or wrong. I shouldn't draw a definite or specific conclusion. And thirdly, a hasty generalization. This is simply a generalization that is unfair. Everybody generalizes. The social sciences are filled with generalizations. There isn't anything wrong with generalizing. We often have to make statements about groups based upon the data that we receive. But we can be careful in the way that we present generalizations. Here's a hasty generalization. Quote, I've worked with 3 born-again Christians. All 3 were obnoxious and had holier-than-thou attitude. Born-again people in their churches are a bunch of hypocrites. Well, what would I say about that? By the way, I got that. I should tell you where I got that from. I was playing on a softball team, and my wife was sitting with all the wives. My wife was the only Christian, and somebody brought up being a born-again Christian. And that's what they said about born-again Christians. So my wife's sitting there quiet, and she told me that later. Well, how do we think about something like that? Christians, of course, are sinful people whom God has forgiven, and they're certainly capable of exhibiting bad behavior and poor attitudes. But to judge a whole group of people based upon the actions of few individuals represents a hasty, or one might say, sweeping generalization. You have to be careful. If you want to say something about all women or all men or all members of an ethnic group, you have to be very careful that you don't commit a hasty generalization. When you generalize, you got to make sure you have solid data and that you're careful in the way that you reason about these things. Okay, principle number 5. We're halfway through our 10 principles. Number 5, ensure that the arguments reflect clarity of thought and expression. You know, when I'm thinking about something, or I'm going to give a presentation, or I'm going to write about something, I ask myself 5 questions, and they all start with the letter C. Am I thinking, is it clear? Is it concise? Is it careful? Is it careful? Is it cogent? And is it compelling? And what I do there is simply take some of the things that I've learned from logic, and I use them as a checklist. If I'm going to give a sermon, if I'm going to debate on an apologetic issue, if I'm writing an article for a blog or for a magazine, or if I'm writing a book, is what I'm thinking about, speaking about, writing about, is it clear? I like to ask myself the question, can I state something clearly so that even a person who doesn't have a lot of background can follow it? Is it clear? Is it concise? Is it careful? Is it cogent? And hopefully it's compelling. Clarity is really critical, because if people are confused, if people misunderstand, if you equivocate, these are all big problems when it comes to reasoning. So, 2 fallacies, equivocation and amphiboly, demonstrate the problems that occur when words are ambiguous or sentences violate grammatical rules. Now something can be unclear in 2 different ways. It can be unclear because it's blurred or fuzzy, or it can be unclear because it's open to multiple interpretations. So you have to be careful about your use of words and language. This error occurs when the conclusion of an argument depends upon the multiple uses, ambiguity of a term. Usually the lack of clarity involved leads to a faulty conclusion, as the following example illustrates. Here's one of my favorite ones. I put it in A World of Difference. I'm a nobody. Nobody's perfect, therefore I'm perfect. I'm a nobody. Nobody is perfect, therefore I'm perfect. Now, what's going on here? Well, clearly nobody is being used in two different ways. I'm a nobody. What does that nobody mean? I think it means, you know, nobody really knows who I am. I'm not a celebrity. I'm a nobody. But then the second use of nobody, nobody is perfect, that really is everybody is imperfect. So I'm a nobody, nobody's perfect, therefore I'm perfect. While that's clever and funny, and I'm glad I put it in my book, it actually leads to a misunderstanding because language isn't being used carefully enough. Now, we also have what we call an amphiboly. And in an amphiboly, the conclusion depends on an ambiguous statement, the improper grammar or syntax that causes the reader or listener to draw an erroneous conclusion. Here's an example. I always like to bring my son in. Quote, Professor Sample's son Michael likes learning about World War II more than his father. But how can a boy care more about learning than about his dad? Well, the question there is, does my son, Michael Samples, enjoy studying World War II more than I, Professor Samples, like studying World War II? Or does my son, Michael, actually like the war more than he likes me? Well, I can tell you that he likes me just a little bit more than he does studying World War II. Again, one of the problems that we have with a lack of clarity is when our language is not careful. Run-on sentences, the multiple uses of words, this leads to a lack of clarity. So again, as I rehearse when I'm preparing a presentation, and let's say I'm thinking about something that is fairly complicated, maybe Anselm's ontological argument for the existence of God, I will ask myself, can I state that argument with real clarity? So that even a person who's not initiated with philosophy can grasp it, get their mind around it. Clarity. Okay, principle number 6. Identify the right kind of evidence necessary to make a good argument. Now, this is an important one because you probably would use different kind of evidence to support different kinds of conclusions. Let me simply ask you this. If you wanted to argue that God exists, what kind of things would you appeal to? What kind of evidence would you appeal to try to support the conclusion that there is a God, that God exists, the God of the Bible exists? Now, as you think about that, let me ask you a little bit of a different question. What kind of evidence would you use to support the conclusion that Ken Samples is a good father? Would you use the same kind of arguments to support the conclusion that God exists, or would you change up? Or what if you were trying to make the claim that there are Oreo cookies in the pantry? How would you support that? Or what if you were trying to support the idea that there are magnetic fields in nature? My point here is simply to raise the issue, think carefully about the kinds of evidence that you present to support an argument, because there are different kinds of evidence that seemingly support different kinds of conclusions. This error in reasoning mixes ideas or categories that do not belong together. Apples are compared with oranges. Here are three examples of the problem that I'm highlighting. Quote, that musical arrangement without lyrics is morally evil. Really? Can sounds be evil? Can musical notes constitute a violation of morality? There are some people who think that way, that certain beats are evil. But how does that work? How do musical notes go into the realm of moral principles? Or what does the color red smell like? Well, I don't think that when it comes to colors, you appeal to a sense of smell. Those are different categories. Here is another one that I think people often mistake. Why can't God, an invisible, transcendent spiritual being, why can't he be seen? I've met, by the way, many college students who have said to me during one of my religion or philosophy courses, or maybe after class, they would say things like, Professor Samples, I'd believe in God if I could see him. And I said, well, do you believe in things you cannot see? You can't see the laws of logic. You can't see mathematical principles. You really can't see love. Aren't there many things that you believe in that you can't see? And what this says is, of course, Christianity says that God, the second person of the Trinity, took a human nature to himself and became man. We have to be careful about mixing categories. If you're arguing for something, make sure that the premises that support that conclusion really relate to that conclusion. Principle number 7, respond directly to an opponent's argument and avoid character-related issues unless they're the logical issue at hand. I think that this is a very easy fallacy to commit. It's, by the way, called the ad hominem. Hominem is the Latin word for man. The ad hominem fallacy, or the argument against the person, occurs when someone presents his point and a competitor argues that point, and the competitor ignores that point and attacks the opponent's character instead. So you make a case for your position. I ignore your argument, and then I just attack your character. I say, you know, only stupid people believe what you believe. I attack your character. That's the ad hominem. And the problem with that is that none of that is relevant. This tactic is not only rude and offensive, but also logically unacceptable because it violates two core principles of reasoning. First, a person has an intellectual responsibility to respond to the content of an argument. Second, a person's character is irrelevant to whether his argument is true. Even morally flawed people can present sound arguments. I mean, if I make a case for the Lakers being the best basketball team, and you ignore my argument for the Lakers being the best basketball team, and you simply attack my character, everything you've said is irrelevant to my initial argument. And we can always at some point attack somebody's character. But the truth of the matter is that even people who have deep moral flaws are still capable of making sound arguments. Stay away from the ad hominem. Stay away from attacking a person's character unless their character is the issue at hand. Here's an example of the ad hominem abusive. This is denouncing character. This is old-fashioned name-calling. The American political scene supplies two easy examples. Quote, Democrats are just a bunch of unpatriotic communist morons. Or, to flip it, quote, Republicans are a gang of heartless, greedy Nazis. How many times in your adult life have you heard Democrats compared to communists? And how many times have you heard Republicans compared to Nazis? Well, you might trace questions of right and left political ideas, but the Democrats are not communists, at least not all of them. And the Republicans are not Nazis, at least not all of them. But immediately, it's easy to take particular groups that we see as being really bad or really evil, and we associate the political party with which we disagree. Stay away from the attacks on people's character. You know, if somebody presents their argument to you, then respond to their argument. Leave their character alone. Because you might even be right in the things you're accusing them of, but that's irrelevant as to whether they've made a good argument or not. Stay away from people's character. Unless the character is the issue at hand. I'll give you an example. You know, if I'm on jury duty, and the guy who is testifying in the case has been found guilty of lying on the stand multiple times, I need to know that as a juror, because I'm deciding whether this person is to be believed. So there are times where a person's character is the relevant issue. In the ad hominem, however, it's not the relevant issue. Principle number 8. Take the time and effort to gain a correct understanding of an opponent's position. Now, I don't know about you, but sometimes when I'm arguing with people, and by the way, you can vigorously argue with someone without your jugular vein popping out. You don't, your face doesn't have to get red. That's a different kind of arguing. You can have a very serious and very deliberate argument without getting mad. But I will tell you something about myself. Sometimes when I argue with people, I'm not listening to what they're saying. I'm waiting until they shut up so I can jump back into the argument. That's not a good thing. If you really care about the truth and you really want to reason with someone, then you should try, you should do your best to listen to your opponent's argument. Now, why do I say that? Well, you should take the time to get the argument right. When one person distorts the argument of another and then proceeds to critique that misrepresentation, whether in writing or speaking, he commits the informal logical fallacy known as the straw man. A straw man may be an extreme or exaggerated version of another's position, or an oversimplification of it. Any criticism of a distorted view lacks relevance. So if you make an argument, and you're arguing for your eschatological position of amillennialism, and I distort your argument, I make it look more extreme, or I make it look oversimplified, and of course when something is exaggerated or it's deeply simplified, it's easy for those arguments to be false. But if I misrepresent your argument, then nothing I say about your argument has any relevance at all. And so if I really want to critique your argument, I need to get your argument right. And then I need to provide a careful, thoughtful critique. This fallacy was so named because of the case with which a straw image can be knocked down as opposed to a real man made of bone and muscle. So too, it is easier to dispose of an exaggerated or simplistic argument than a well-balanced and substantive argument. So if I misrepresent your argument, I've created a straw man. And it's easy to knock down an exaggerated argument. It's not easy to knock down something that has real substance. We have the responsibility intellectually, and I would argue morally as Christians, to get another person's argument right. Why? Because we care about the truth. So we have to be careful when we approach people's arguments. The straw man fallacy is often committed in a face-to-face argument, especially a heated one, because a person may be thinking about her or his response instead of listening carefully. I'm guilty of that. I'm arguing with somebody, they're presenting their argument, and I'm not really thinking carefully about what they're saying because I'm just thinking about what I'm going to say next when they stop talking. A good way to avoid misrepresentation and irrelevance is to restate an opponent's argument back to him. Let me make sure I understand your argument. Are you saying, this practice can produce positive results, including better listening, clearer understanding, and more successful communication? You know, I do that sometimes. Sometimes when I'm having an argument, I will simply take a breath, listen carefully to what my opponent says, and then I'll see if I can track his or her reason. I'll say, okay, it seems to me, if I'm understanding you correctly, you're making this claim, and here is the support that you're providing for that claim. Now, am I correct? And of course, when I'm able to do that, there are a lot of benefits from doing that. I think that's probably what St. Peter meant in 1 Peter 3:15. Always be ready to give to every man an answer, a reason for the hope that you have. But then Peter talks about demeanor and attitude, gentleness, respect, keeping a clear conscience. William Lane Craig, in his book Reasonable Faith, Dr. Craig is a well-known Christian apologist. Craig argues in that book, of course, he provides a lot of evidence to support the truth of the Christian faith. But I thought it interesting in one chapter at the end of the book, Craig argues that often it's more about our character than it is about what we say when it comes to leading people to the truth of Christianity. Now, that's a very profound thing for Craig to say, because Craig is really a sharp guy, and he spends a lot of his time presenting arguments for the truth of the Christian faith. But I think Craig is right. Oftentimes, we can convince people by the demeanor and the attitude that we possess. They may care less about what we say and more about the kind of person we are. Now, of course, all of this is in conjunction with the grace of God. But it's a powerful point. Maybe when you're arguing with somebody and you're not getting anywhere, maybe you ought to just stop and say, well, wait a second, we don't seem to be getting anywhere. Let me see if I can restate your argument back to you. Now, having said that, sometimes when I do that, my opponent will say, wow, that's pretty cool. You actually listen to what I have to say, and you're actually able to state it back. And they might decide, hey, maybe I'll do that. Maybe they'll feel like I'm being charitable. Maybe they'll feel that I'm giving them respect. People want to be heard. Okay, principle number 9, stay on topic when offering a rebuttal. Closely associated with the straw man error is the red herring fallacy. When someone diverts attention from the real issue by focusing on an extraneous or secondary matter, he leads his opponent down an unproductive side trail. The herring fish was reportedly used in English fox hunts to try to draw hunting dogs off the track. A change in subject, even if subtle, results in a loss of logical relevance. So what is the red herring? That's when I make an argument and you change the subject. That's a red herring. It's a diversionary tactic. You're trying to get me off the track. Herring, any of you have ever eaten herring? I like herring. I like to eat it right out of the can. It's a smelly, smelly fish. And so in the old days, if you broke out of jail and the dogs were on your trail, you'd get some herring fish and rub it across the trail. And soon as the hounds got the herring in their scent, they weren't worried about you anymore. They were off the track, the diversionary tactic. Well, if we're arguing and I make my case and you change the subject, then everything you say is irrelevant to my argument. You gotta stay on track when looking at the rebuttal. Here's a couple of examples. One example, quote, you have argued against the so-called plague of abortion on demand based upon your pro-life convictions. But war, famine, and disease cause millions of deaths every year throughout the world. Shouldn't we be addressing those issues? I hear that all the time. Somebody will make a case, a pro-life position, that human beings have inherent dignity and moral worth and they should be protected, whether they're unwanted or not. And somebody will simply say, well, wait a second, there are a lot of people who die. People die in war, they die of famines, they die of disease. What about them? Well, I would say, look, I'm happy to talk about war, famine, and disease, but right now we're talking about abortion on demand. That's the issue at hand. The main point, the intentional killing of unborn humans because they're unwanted, has been shifted to unrelated deaths. A diversionary tactic is simply to change the subject. But once you do, everything you say is irrelevant to your opponent's argument. Number 10. We finally made it to number 10. Render a fair assessment of all evidence for an opponent's position. You know, what I'm talking about here is I'm talking about reasoning with people and emphasizing fairness. I'm talking about intellectual honesty. I'm talking about what Christians call charity. I think oftentimes when we engage in arguments with people, logical or otherwise, we're often trying to win. I would simply say that I think Christians should care about the truth. Because ultimately, God is truth with a capital T. I think from a Christian point of view, truth is a sacred thing. And we should care more about discovering the truth, apprehending the truth, understanding the truth, than we should care about winning. So render a fair assessment of all evidence for an opponent's position. Compounding other errors in argumentation is the commonly committed fallacy of suppressed evidence. It occurs when an arguer emphasizes only the evidence that supports his or her position, while suppressing counter-evidence that may point toward or even require a different conclusion. So you and I are looking at a position, and there's evidence for your position and there's evidence against it. If you ignore the evidence that's against your position, you have suppressed the evidence. You have to be honest, or you should be honest. It's much better to say, you know, the data is kind of divided. Some of it does support my conclusion. Some of it doesn't. Let's take a look more carefully at that kind of evidence. The rules of logic and good reasoning compel truth seekers to deal honestly and transparently with facts, evidence, and all relevant data. A candid admission of tentativeness about one's own position or worldview reflects a refreshing and attractive intellectual integrity. Again, I think that when we share our faith with other people, or we want to persuade people to consider the claims of Jesus Christ, I think those people are asking, is this person believable? Is this someone that I can take to communicate with honesty and integrity? I think those are very important things, and we should never suppress evidence. When evidence points away from one's own position, it is better, even obligatory, to acknowledge a compelling argument than to shade the truth or engage in intellectual dishonesty. Unfortunately, a strong temptation to engage in deck stacking makes the fallacy of suppressed evidence easy to commit. Given this reality, if an advocate for one position appears to have ignored or diminished appropriate evidence against that position, then by all means, an opponent should make the broader picture known. Am I going to be honest in looking at the evidence? You know, I might have a hypothesis. I might think, you know, the data tends to support my position, but what about the evidence that may not support your position? I often tell college students, maybe in an ethics course, I'll say, okay, take a controversial ethical point of view and vigorously argue your point of view. You know, maybe you want to argue for or against abortion, for or against capital punishment, for or against stem cell research. But I say, after you make your argument, I want you to look at the other side and tell me the best argument on the other side and how you would respond to it. Often I have students come back and say, you know, I never knew there was a good argument on the other side. Well, how do you respond to it? How do you respond to the best critique from the other side? The passionate pursuit of truth demands nothing less than a commitment to sound reasoning and honorable intellectual exchange. Arguments shaped by logical and moral ethical principles establish well-reasoned and persuasive positions that are able to withstand scrutiny in everyday reality. Incorporating the essential virtues of honesty, fair play, charity increases a person's ability to defend any particular position. And what it comes down to is, even though I'd like to win, I care more about getting it right. I care more about the truth. And I want to extend to people, even people who disagree with me, a sense of charity. Those are high standards. We don't often live up to them. You know, part of being a sinner is not just that we sometimes have moral problems. Sometimes we have intellectual problems. I have a new book coming out in just a week or so. It's called The Seven Truths That Changed the World, Discovering Christianity's Most Dangerous Ideas. But when I was writing the book, I realized that when I am arguing for the truth of my faith, I need to be very careful not to misrepresent other people's views and that I needed to try my best to incorporate these kind of 10 principles. Because if I want somebody to read a book that I've written, I want to be intellectually honest. I want to be fair. I want to be careful. And of course, our textbooks for this class teach us those things. As I've said many times, I had a master's degree, and then I read the Adler Van Doren book, and I realized I didn't know a whole lot about reading. So if you haven't read the How to Read a Book by Adler and Van Doren, you've missed a contemporary classic. I can't say the same about my book, but I hope it's thoughtful and I hope it's challenging. And these, of course, are our two textbooks. So let's take a break. We'll take a 15-minute break. I think there's some coffee and maybe something to snack on. When we come back, before we quit. Next week, week number 7, so we only got 2 more weeks left in our class. We've now shifted from reading to logic. The next 2 weeks, we'll look at worldview reflection. Heavenly Father, we are grateful we can come to you and that we have a relationship with you through your Son. And Father, we're thankful for the work of the Holy Spirit, and we realize, Lord, that no one comes to Christ simply by purely logical arguments. Lord, we know that your Spirit softens people's hearts and clears the cobwebs from their mind and inclines their will. And Father, we're grateful that you have called us to believe in the gospel, that you care about us, you hear our prayers, you are guiding and directing our lives. And Father, I pray that all of our intellectual abilities would not only help us to discover the truth, but even more, they would bring glory to you and to your Son and to your Spirit. And we praise you tonight. Amen.